I'll say just a word of thanks to Anthony this morning for his excellent comments prior to the Lord's Supper. I think they're very powerful, very well said, and good reminders of things that we need to be aware of with respect to the Lord's Supper and think about as we take the Lord's Supper. I appreciated the fine job that he did. And I want to say that I'm thankful for a prayer that was led last Sunday evening by Joe Sims. In that prayer, he asked God to bless the new congregation that's being formed to meet very soon in the Monrovia area. And I was touched by that prayer. When the elders put out a poll form last October asking the congregation for their input about what needed to be done concerning the fact that we tend to be overcrowded on Sunday mornings, that we've kind of reached our capacity in terms of seating in this building. I was one of the ones who said that I thought we needed to form a new congregation. And I was interested in being a part of that work. That's what I put on my form. And when that came to fruition, the effort to have another congregation in the Monrovia area, and I was asked to work with that congregation, I willingly agreed to do that because I believe it represents for me and for them some unique opportunities, some additional opportunities for evangelism, particularly in the area of Monrovia. And I think that God is blessing the efforts of that group in striving to come together and form a new congregation. That's a rather labor-intensive thing. A lot of details, a lot of things that have to be prepared and that have to be looked to in order to start a new congregation on stable footing. And that has been blessed, I believe, by God. But I appreciated Joe's prayer. And I am assuming that, without any reservation, that his prayer is simply added to the prayer of all the brethren here, who would like to see these efforts at evangelism succeed, who wish the very best for their brethren. That's just what brethren do. That's how brotherly love works, is that it wishes the best of success for other brethren in those things that they are doing that are good and right and proper. And so I appreciate and I solicit your continued prayers, not just on my behalf, as I work with them in the near future, but also for all of those brethren as they strive to do a very important work in the community in which many of them actually live. Some of you have probably played this game, maybe with mixed success. The game I'm talking about is a game called Scruples. If you've never played the game, it's not a real complicated game. Basically, in order to win the game, you have to be able to lie convincingly. They use the word bluff. That's just a synonym for lie. You have to be able to convince other people that you're telling the truth when in fact you're not. Ever tried to play that game with a bunch of Christians? It's like playing with Vulcans. Not that we're aliens. But it's just and I feel funny, if you have to explain a comment, an illustration about Vulcans, you know you're getting old. But for the younger generation who may not be Trekkies or may not be familiar with Jim and Doc and Spock, the Vulcan, on the original Star Trek program, or at least the one that I grew up with, Spock was a Vulcan, and Vulcans can't lie. In fact, every once in a while, Jim would kind of test his information by asking Spock, because he knew Spock wouldn't lie. It wasn't until the movies came out that Spock started to kind of deviate from the truth occasionally. But in the original series, Vulcans didn't lie. Can you imagine playing Scruples with people who can't lie? They're physically unable to lie. Now, Christians can lie. They shouldn't. But they can lie, but I'll tell you something, they oughtn't to be very good at it. Because they ought to lack practice. And so, when a bunch of Christians get together to play the game Scruples, usually things don't go all that well. And the reason is, there's a fundamental principle that that game is not observing. And that principle is that character influences behavior and makes behavior even predictable. How many times have you seen on the television, following some terrible act of violence, maybe even murder, maybe even serial murder in some neighborhood, one neighbor against another neighbor, and they always will interview somebody who says, "He was such a nice man. I would never have dreamed that he would have committed this kind of crime. I can't believe he's a mass murderer. The evidence is there. What do you mean you can't believe?" What they're saying is, this doesn't fit. What I know about this man's character doesn't fit with what you're saying he did. And all that betrays is that we operate on the principle that character influences behavior and it makes behavior predictable. Most of us probably know at least one person well enough that we can predict how that person is going to react in most situations. If you've been married for a number of years, it's probably your spouse. You know what they like. You know what they don't like. You know how they react to certain things. Men learn after a while. There are just certain things you don't do because you know how they react. It may be your best friend, somebody known for years. And so because you know their character, you can predict, at least in many ways, with some certainty, some accuracy, their behavior. And so as the game scruples illustrates, and as this principle that it ignores illustrates, we expect certain behavior from Christians because we know the character for which the Christian strives to develop. And so we expect certain behavior out of them. One of the character traits that greatly influences the Christian's behavior and dress for that matter is that of modesty, sense of shame. And so this morning I want to talk to you a little bit about this business of dressed for influence, of the way that we dress ourselves. And I'm going to do two things. I want to take the principle that we've illustrated with the game scruples, and I want to apply that same principle to dress. I think the application is very easy. We'll not spend a lot of time on it. You'll see it, make the application yourself very easily. And then I want to notice particularly the importance of dress to our influence. There are some people who will say you can't judge a book by its color. It doesn't make any difference the clothes that a person wears. That doesn't determine who they are. And there's some truth to that. But as we're going to see, there's some truth also to the fact that we are going to be judged by the way that we dress, by others, and that will either increase or decrease our influence with them as we strive to teach them, to influence them for Jesus Christ. Those of you who are familiar with the New Testament, even in a passing way, are probably familiar with the fact that the New Testament writers do not reveal some sort of dress code, but that rather they emphasize the importance of developing the inner man with the reasoning that the outer man, the appearance and our behavior, our conduct, will reflect the condition, the character of the inner man. One of the passages that we sometimes refer to is 1 Peter the 3rd chapter, verses 1 through 4. Gary read that passage for us. I appreciate him doing that on short notice. And I want to emphasize verses 3 and 4. Of course, the passage begins by following the theme of 1 Peter 2, and then, of course, in chapter 3, the theme of submission to various relationships. But look at verse 3, where Peter says, "Do not let your adornment be merely outward, arranging the hair, wearing gold, or putting on fine apparel. Rather, let it be the hidden person of the heart, with the incorruptible beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God." And so Peter makes the very clear point that emphasis needs to be placed on the inner man, on the character of a man, of a person rather than his or her appearance. It's also interesting to me that when you read verses 3 and 4, there's not a contrast between skimpy clothing and character, or immodesty and character, but rather the contrast is drawn between the gentle and quiet, or some versions say meek spirit, and drawing attention to oneself. If you look at the verse 3, it's the arranging of the hair, wearing gold, or putting on fine apparel. Nothing is said there about what we typically think of as immodest apparel, but rather those were things that were designed to draw attention to the appearance of one, and that's fundamental to the concept of modesty. The attitude of not attempting to draw attention to our physical appearance, and particularly in unchaste ways. Character determines conduct. The hidden person of the heart, if properly adorned with this gentle and quiet spirit that Peter writes about, will manifest chaste conduct. Now let's reread the passage beginning in verse 1. Wives, likewise, be submissive to your own husbands, that even if some do not obey the word, they without a word may be won by the conduct of their wives, when they observe your chaste conduct accompanied by fear. And then in verses 3 and 4, he begins to talk about how they should adorn themselves. Isn't it interesting that he follows his introduction of chaste conduct by talking about how the inner person is to be adorned? Verse 4 ends that it should be instead with the incorruptible beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God. Another passage that similarly places emphasis on the inner man as opposed to the outward appearance is 1 Timothy 2, verses 9 and 10. The writer here, Apostle Paul, says in like manner also that the women adorn themselves in modest apparel with propriety and moderation, not with braided hair or gold or pearls or costly clothing, but which is proper for women professing godliness with good works. And so again, the emphasis is not on the things that are skimpy, but on the things that draw attention to oneself. And Paul suggests that women need to be more concerned. He's addressing women in this passage. Women need to be more concerned with adorning the inner man or adorning the character with good works than with those things that draw attention to their outward appearance. And Paul also makes the observation that the twin virtues of propriety and moderation are necessary. The word propriety is an interesting word. Even more interesting, perhaps, is the translation of the American Standard Version. It uses the word shamefastness. When was the last time you used the word shamefastness? We'll talk about the meaning of that. It's an interesting word, but it has a very powerful message to convey. We'll talk about that in just a moment. The other word is the word moderation. It is a word that, by definition, simply means sound judgment. It talks about self-control and or decency. Women who profess godliness, Paul writes, will adorn their lives with good works. The word godliness speaks of the devotion in a person that attempts to please God. The godly person is the one who strives to do only that which is pleasing to God. And God desires that His people be engaged in good works. There are many passages in the New Testament, Ephesians 2:10 and Titus chapter 2 and verse 14. In fact, one of the themes of Titus is good works. There are many passages that talk about the need for Christians to be involved in good works, for them to adorn themselves in good works. I want to come back, however, to that word propriety a little bit to suggest that another factor in modest apparel, and for that matter, modest behavior, is a sense of shame. As we've already noted, a woman's clothing and her behavior ought to be determined by a sense of shame, or it ought to be with propriety. But the word shamefast is a word that I think sometimes brings up an unfortunate connotation. The idea is that in some way we are ashamed of ourselves. that somehow our intrinsic worth as a person is something that we're ashamed of. And that's not at all the idea of the idea or the concept of a sense of shame. God created us, and each one of us has been endowed with an immortal spirit given by God. And because of that, we are of value that is inestimable. That's not the concept behind a sense of shame, but rather shamefast, as the American Standard Version translates that word, suggests the idea of being bound in one's conduct by a sense of shame. A sense of shame of doing at doing that which is immoral or that which is dishonorable. When people do things that are not with propriety, that are outrageous, that are lewd, that are wrong, that are immoral, they ought to be ashamed. The fact of the matter is that shame has become a rather scarce commodity in our society. I never cease to be amazed. I don't know why it keeps amazing me, but television just keeps getting more and more risque and bold in the things that they're willing to portray. Every once in a while, Debbie and I will be watching a program, and one of us will look at the other and say, "What was that commercial about? Was that really about tires?" Because the content of the commercial seems to be about a whole lot of other things. Most of them portrayals of immorality or immodest clothing, that sort of thing. The most wicked and perverse behavior in our society is committed openly. And there doesn't seem to be a lot of shame or embarrassment either on the part of the perpetrators, those who do it, or those who observe it. We just kind of say, well, that's just the way this society is. That's just America. It's a free society, free country. You can do what you want. The prophet Jeremiah, early in his ministry in chapter 8, makes this observation about the people that he was preaching to. He says, "Were they ashamed when they had committed abominations?" No. He answers his own question. They were not all ashamed, nor did they know how to blush. These were people who could see the most shameful, immoral things going on, didn't bother them. They'd become used to those things. How have we come to that as a society? Well, that's a whole nother sermon. Let me just make this observation that we cease to be shocked because we repeatedly allow ourselves to be exposed to the shameful. If we keep seeing it, at some point it won't bother us anymore. And there's a strong argument there for how we ought to police our homes. We lose our sense of shame when we repeatedly commit those acts which are shameful. The first few times it may bother us, but with time it doesn't bother us anymore. We've been desensitized to the shamefulness of the thing. And so we just do it without thinking about it anymore. After all, that's what everybody does. In fact, it even makes us wonder why other people question it, because we have accepted it as so normal and so average. Everybody's doing it. Women, it seems, often engage in shocking behavior or wear indecent clothing in order to be noticed. Maybe some of you have caught wind of the same thing that I have noticed. It's a little hard if you spend much time on the internet reading even news to avoid this kind of information. But at the various awards assemblies where celebrities gather, the contest now among women there is to see which one can come with the least clothing or the most transparent clothing. And even the news agencies have expressed some surprise at what some of the women are willing to wear on those occasions, in those circumstances. Why? Why? Are they so silly they don't understand what most of us just understand almost intuitively? And that is that outrageousness, like many other things, conforms to the law of diminishing returns. If you are outrageous today, you may attract attention, but tomorrow's a new day. And other people are also doing what you did today, so tomorrow you got to push the envelope a little bit more. You've got to be more risque. You've got to be more immodest. You've got to be more outrageous. And they're trying to outdo each other while America watches. I cannot help but believe that some women engage in this shocking behavior, or they wear indecent clothing because they so desperately want to be noticed and admired that they will court and accept even the lascivious attention of evil men because it boosts their own self-worth. A woman's estimation of her personal worth is sometimes determined, at least in her own mind, by the attention that she can attract with her appearance. You think of the most beautiful, beautiful women in America, in Hollywood, and TV's always trying to tell us who those people are. And tell me why any of those people are more valuable than the ugliest woman you know. There is no reason. There's no way to answer that question. Because your value doesn't depend upon your appearance. Young people are taught that from the very beginning of their life. And boy, it really gets driven home when they get into the teenage years. And it's the good-looking people, whatever that means in our generation. In my generation, what it meant was. and so then you get measured by what your generation thinks is good looking, and if you're not part of that group, your nose is too long, your ears are too big, you don't wear your clothes tight enough or low enough or whatever, guys don't run around without shirts, then you just don't belong and you're off in the periphery. You're not going to be one of the special people. We teach people that the value that they have as people depends on what they look like and how they dress. And that's a myth. Because what makes me valuable and what makes you valuable is not our appearance. Aren't you grateful for me for that? Aren't you glad on my behalf that that's the truth? I want to spend just a moment or two, just some final comments about a story that is told in Genesis, the 38th chapter. Genesis 38. We're going to use this story to make our second point, fulfill our second objective. In Genesis 38, in the first six verses, there's a lot of history there, family history, that's given in a very succinct fashion. Judah, one of the sons, the 12 brethren of Jacob, Judah has left his brethren, and he's gone and married a woman outside the family. Her name is Shua. And he had three sons by this woman. Their names, if you're looking, are in the first six verses. Their names were Onan, and Shelah. Gets married. But the Bible says that he was a wicked man and the Lord killed him. Levirate marriage was the practice of a brother going in and taking another brother's wife, widow, to be his own wife if that first brother who died didn't have any children. That way, his line wouldn't be extinguished. His genealogy wouldn't be extinguished. And so Onan is the one who needs to perform that function, that family duty. And he's unwilling to do that. In fact, he goes to great lengths to avoid providing his brother with an heir. And the Lord kills him too. And Judah, who apparently was pretty good at math, said, I've lost one son and a second son. I've only got one son left. And this woman Tamar, she was the wife of the first two brethren. She's kind of hard on sons. And so he told her to wait, just to live in her father's household until such time as the third son would be old enough to go ahead and do what the second son hadn't done. But his willingness to do that was suspect, apparently, and Tamar gets tired of waiting, so she sets a trap for her father-in-law, for Judah. And that's where we want to pick up the story, beginning in verse 13. Let's go to verse 12. Now, in the process of time, the daughter of Shua, Judah's wife, died, and Judah was comforted and went up to his sheep shearers at Timnah, he and his friend Hiram, the Adullamite. And it was told Tamar, saying, "Look, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep." So she took off her widow's garments, covered herself with a veil, and wrapped herself and sat in an open place, which was on the way to Timnah. For she saw that Shelah was grown, and she was not given to him as a wife. When Judah saw her, he thought she was a harlot, because she'd covered her face. Then he turned to her by the way and said, "Please let me come in to you." For he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. So she said, "What will you give me that you may come in to me?" And he said, "I will send a young goat from the flock." So she said, "Will you give me a pledge until you send it?" And the transaction takes place. Now she ends up acting as a harlot. But my point is that Judah assumed she was a harlot. I think I called Judah's wife Shua. She was the daughter of Shua. But anyway, Judah thinks Tamar is a harlot, not because he's seen her engaged in prostitution, but because of the way she acted and the way she dressed. There's a way that a harlot dresses. It is obviously to attract attention to her physical body. And she acted and dressed like a harlot. Judah made an assumption about her. The fact of the matter is, she was a widow. And apparently up to this time, hadn't engaged in harlotry. In fact, verse 14 says that she wore the garments of a widow. She put aside her widow's garments. That identified her as a widow. And she put on a different outfit. And that outfit identified her as a harlot as far as Judah was concerned. Now, she eventually acted as a prostitute. But Judah judged her to be one based on her conduct and her dress, and that says volumes. Turn now, if you will, to the book of Proverbs, to chapter 7. Proverbs chapter 7. In the early part of this chapter, the proverb writer warns about the immoral woman, that young men need to be cautious about becoming involved with the immoral woman. But I want you to see the description of this immoral woman, and we're going to begin reading. We're only going to just read just a very little of this. If you'll go to verse 5, the text says that they may keep you from the immoral woman, from the seductress who flatters with her words. "For at the window of my house I looked through my lattice and saw among the simple, I perceived among the youths, a young man devoid of understanding, passing along the street near her corner, and he took the path to her house. In the twilight, in the evening, in the black and dark night. And there a woman met him with the attire of a harlot and a crafty heart. She was loud and rebellious. Her feet would not stay at home. At times she was outside, at times in the open square, lurking at every corner." And my point is this. She dressed like an immoral woman, like a woman with no restraint. And she acted like a woman with no moral restraint. And this young man assumes that she is. Appearance is important because it affects our influence with others. You can't judge a book by its cover. As I said, there's some truth to that. I could dress up as a pirate, but that doesn't make me a pirate. I can dress up as a doctor or a football player or a soldier, but it doesn't make me any of those things. I've seen Ralph Etheridge dressed up as the Incredible Hulk. But I don't think he's the Incredible Hulk, although from this point forward, I'll not make him angry if I can avoid it. Just because you dress in a certain way doesn't necessarily make you that. And all I'm saying is that every woman who dresses immodestly is not necessarily a harlot. But the principle is that we tend to form judgments about people's character based in part on the way they dress. And that is a very true principle. It's illustrated in these passages. Immodest clothing doesn't make a woman a prostitute, but her attire says to others that she lacks moral restraint, that she's not ashamed for others, men in particular, to see her body. I wonder if a Christian can exert good influence over others if she is perceived as morally unrestrained, or perhaps even subject to sexual promiscuity based on the way she dresses and the way she acts. And one final comment. In light of the principles that are involved, modesty is not only a feminine issue. Men also need to be concerned about the privacy principle and the stumbling block principles. But it is interesting that the Scriptures address women on this subject, and I think what it reflects is the sexual differences between men and women. Let's conclude this morning by making this observation. The Bible says that we're the light of the world. Christ's disciples described as the light of the world, salt of the earth. And yet the truth of the matter is much of our influence is not verbal. It's found in the things that we do. It's found even in our appearance. I wonder, how's my influence doing? How's your influence doing with the people who watch you from day to day? What would it take to make us blush? That is, to be embarrassed, to be ashamed. When Adam and Eve felt ashamed about their nakedness, when they were no longer innocent, when they had violated God's law, they were ashamed of the fact that they were naked, and they made coverings for themselves out of fig leaves. And it wasn't enough. God made more permanent clothes, apparently more modest clothing for them out of skins. When we don't clothe ourselves in modest apparel, evidently we've lost some measure of our sense of shame. And we need to go back and take a good hard look at what God's Word says about what's moral and what's immoral to regain that sense of shame so that we can act and dress with propriety, with moderation, with modesty. I really appreciate your attention this morning. Scott Jordan, this last week, put on Christ. That's the language that the Apostle Paul uses. In fact, the word that he uses is the same word that in secular Greek would have been used to talk about putting on clothing. We're not talking about modesty here, as Steve pointed out so correctly. What we're talking about is people whose lives have been stained by sin, who have violated God's law, and yet, through the blood of Jesus Christ, they're washed, and in the language of the book of Revelation, they're enabled to wear white robes of holiness. Scott's wearing a white shirt this morning, but more importantly, he put on Christ. And in doing that, he formed a relationship with Christ. Through his obedience to the gospel, his soul was cleansed, and now his mind continues to be renewed through the agency of the Spirit, sanctification of the Word. Do you need to do the same thing this morning? I'm not talking about clothing anymore. I'm talking about putting on Christ. I'm talking about becoming a child of God. And if you need to do that this morning, by expressing your faith, what you feel is true about Jesus, what you understand to be true about Jesus with all of your heart, then this morning, why not confess that faith and be baptized for the remission of your sins so that you likewise can put on Christ, be a new creature in Him, in the language of the Apostle Paul in 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 17. If we can help you in obeying the gospel, won't you come as we stand and sing?